hope you had a spectacular weekend and got to enjoy some of this beautiful, albeit coolish, summertime weather. I put that in air quotes. I'm Eric Detheridge. You are listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. Greg Blumenschein, who will be back in the hosting chair at long last tomorrow, shares a conversation a little bit later that he had with acclaimed outdoor and conservation writer Jeffrey Miller, the Kindred-based author of Our Bend and the River, Learning to Live a More Natural Life, and countless magazine articles, is back with a new book called The Golden Hour, More Adventures from the Field, Forest, and Water. And in just a few minutes, our former director of radio, Bill Thomas, shares why he's just a little bit leery, or at least was, about eating sushi. But first, for parents of kids with special needs, planning weekend or summer activities can present challenges beyond just finding something to do. There are logistics to keep in mind, like formulating an exit strategy should your kid become overwhelmed. Then there's finding places to play that feel safe and non-judgmental, where the kid can just be. Just off of 25th Street in South Fargo, there is such a place. It's called We Rock the Spectrum Kids Gym, and it's co-owned by Lori Anderson, who originally is from Thief River Falls and grew up in a farming family. I had the chance to talk to Lori over the weekend while my daughter and a bunch of other kids merrily played in the background.
I can tell that we are gonna be friends.
You know, the first thing you notice when you get here, and it sticks with me, is the little quote on the wall. It says, finally a place where you never have to say, I'm sorry. And that kind of hits parents like me hard. What have you heard from other parents?
Yeah, we've heard just a lot of the same. It's the thing that sticks out first when they walk in, just knowing that they don't have to be afraid if their kids do, you know, make different kinds of sounds that others might not be used to, or if they have a hard time transitioning, they don't have to feel embarrassed about that. They're welcomed here for who they are, and they have that just sense of relief when they come visit our space.
So take us back. This is a national chain, We Rock the Spectrum. So tell us how this all got started and how you became, what, a franchisee with your husband?
Yeah. So before I opened We Rock, I was a program manager providing specialist services on the Minnesota side. So I did that job for 8 years. Before that, I was a DSP since high school. So I've been in the special needs community for a long time. And it was through that and having a lot of clients that had big sensory needs, there was not a good spot for them to go and to burn energy, to make friends, to work on skills where they could be more at ease.
What is a DSP, by the way?
Direct support professional. So it's staff that's with the kiddo or the client, and they help support them in different various ways. But there was just no great spot to go where kids could burn energy, where they could make friends easily, where they had extra support if things did go south or they're having a hard time. So I was just Googling one day sensory gyms because I thought there must be something out there, and I ended up finding We Rock and knew that's what I wanted to do.
We Rock started when and by whom?
It was founded by Dina Kimmel. Her son is on the spectrum, and she wanted to create a space where both her son on the spectrum and neurotypical daughter could play with their friends all together. And so it started from a small space in their house at least 6 years ago, and they grew to a commercial space and then kind of grew from there to over, I think, 100 locations worldwide. So, I mean, it's definitely growing.
Yeah, you look at their map, they're all over the place for locations, but in North Dakota anyway, Fargo is it. So you really fulfilled this need. So it must have been quite a leap to go from working with special needs kids to actually owning a business that that caters to that customer base. I suppose you got a lot of experience knowing what they might want, but just taking that financial leap, what was that like with you and your husband? That was a big risk.
Very scary. Definitely had no business background before, so that part has been a learning journey. It's still learning more and more every day. But I think we're able to be successful because we know we've had experience with kids of all abilities and with parents and families, and really trying to make this a community space for them.
And for them, meaning the parents too, what are they telling you as far as, like, you know, I gave some examples of, like, trying to find things to do on the weekends, especially for kids, and then you find some things, and it's quite an endeavor sometimes to prepare to take them to places where, you know, I guess your neurotypical kids would go on a weekend. But I'm sure you've heard how frustrating that is, and isn't there just some place we can go without also being judged? Did you hear a lot of that from parents?
Yeah, we hear that all the time. And I think it often makes parents feel more isolated in those situations. It's really fun to just to see parents connect with other parents while they're here. And we really help facilitate those things too, not just with parents, but with the kids. So we're out on the floor with the kids and the parents and helping to facilitate those play interactions or make those introductions or explain what might be happening or why they maybe can't use their words. So it's very much informational for those who don't get it. And it helps just create a better sense of belonging, I'd say, where parents then don't feel so isolated or they have to apologize for what their kid's doing. And then we do other things like family nights, so that brings those with special needs together so they can meet other parents going through the same things. Parents night out, we do respite, so just different opportunities to give parents either a break or help them form a community that they might not have.
Yeah, and I have to say, as a beneficiary of one of your birthday parties here for our daughter, meeting those other parents and just having a laugh, you know, being able to sort of laugh about the things that we all have to go through every day and our kids, and just reveling and watching our kids, you know. And it's kind of funny because I think a lot of parents of neurotypical kids don't quite understand that kids like ours, sometimes they don't necessarily play together all the time. They sort of, it's more of adjacency.
More of that parallel play. They might not have the skills to be able to interact typically, I guess, with other kids. They might, you know, oftentimes a lot of kids will be in kind of their own world or do scripted plays. They might recite things from different shows, movies, things they've read, but they're still able to play alongside their peers.
We like to say, and we do say, that our kids are special. It's called special needs. It's called special education. It's a word that gets bandied about a lot, but I think there is really something special about these kids because they think in ways that are just sometimes, I think, on a higher plane than we are able to think. So when you are observing, I mean, you have a watchful eye on all the kiddos out here, as you are right now when we're talking. What are some of the things that you see with these kids? What sort of delights your heart?
I love learning about their special interests. I think that's my favorite thing. And then just hearing them, you know, go off about dinosaur facts. We have so many kids who love dinosaurs. They could probably tell you every single thing there is to know about them. Our ocean animals, space, the alphabet, numbers. And they just light up when you're interested in that. And then I think it's fun to be able to pull other kids into that too. And so they're, you know, sharing those interests with new friends that they maybe wouldn't have been able to do before. Or when you have families that come in here on a routine basis and you're hearing about their small wins. Mm-hmm. Right? And how they've grown. They've said a new word that they weren't saying last week. They were able to do a new skill that they didn't do the week before. They did the zip line for the first time after coming here for 2 years, and they finally had worked up that courage. And it's those things you just see, the pride in the parents' eyes and the delight from the kids, that just makes it all worth it.
Well, and it's results-based, too, because the thing is, if you have a place where these kids are comfortable, they feel at home, they feel like they're part of a community, then they achieve better things while they're here. I mean, they have a more fun playing and interacting than they do in other settings.
Yeah, and that's the thing, too. So it's play, but a lot of it is so many skills that they're gaining, too. So it's those gross motor, fine motor, social skills in the form of play. So we don't do any types of therapies here because I think this is the place where kids can really just be. But at the same time, they're still working and utilizing those skills. So it's just really fun to see.
There's a method to your madness.
There is. We try.
Well, part of the method, it must be sort of a scientific method, and this might be, you know, going back to the mothership, going back to the chain, about the equipment and how it's laid out. And of course, we're in radio. People can't see, but, I mean, we're looking at different sort of sections for different age brackets. But explain to people, like, how this is laid out and what thought went into the equipment and where it is.
Yeah, so we have our large steel structure in the middle of our space that houses all of the swings. So those help with different things like balance, those gross motor skills, different sensory inputs that kids might need. So maybe it's a tight hug from the swing that really helps calm the nervous system. If they need that more excitement, there's things that'll amp them up a little bit more. There's rock wall, rope wall that helps with motor planning, the monkey bars, the zip line. You have to be able to put your body around and hold on and then jump off at the end. There's the arts and crafts area where you work on more of those fine motor skills. So it's coloring, cutting, pasting, puzzles, other smaller items. The infant toddler area, which we don't just block off for infants, toddlers, any kids can use it.
Thank you.
Yes, because a lot have different interests. There's smaller things in there for them to use, color identification, labeling different items, things to jump on that, again, really helps with getting those senses met and to help keep kids regulated when they need that space too. Then we have our calming room. If they need a quieter space to get away, then they're able to go in there and kind of have a reset, and they come back out and join the fun when they're ready.
And so you have regular hours, but you also have lots of things that you do for parents as far as like birthday parties. Describe those extra off-hour stuff that you do.
Yeah, so we do lots of different birthday parties. We offer a few different packages, and then we have one just for kiddos with special needs as well. All parties are private, so you get the facility to yourself. So as a special needs parent too, that's very nice. You don't have to worry about other kids or, you know, coming in the space. You get that whole time to yourself. We do Parents Night Out, so that's the second Friday of every month. That's a drop-off event, so they're here from 5:30 to 8:30. They get pizza. We do themed activities. They get to play. Parents get a break. Then we do summer camp, which is going on right now through, I think, the first week of August. That's for ages 5 through 8. We welcome all abilities for that, and then we do different weekly themes for that as well. We do different events. We've had Bluey come visit before. We do Sensory Santa events, which he's coming back in July for Christmas in July. We're restarting our special needs family nights. So that's gotten a huge response from families. They're very excited about that. So we're going to do a weekday offering and then do some weekends as well for that, just as another way for families to connect with one another. We've also started a resource wall in our facility, so if parents are looking for different resources or are new to the field of special needs, they can check that out, ask questions. We're happy to help connect to different organizations that we know of.
Well, this is an awesome place. What's the best thing you've heard from a parent? What's the best thing you've heard from a kiddo?
Best thing I've heard from a parent would just be that they found people who get it. And they found friends for their kids. And that's something that can be very hard to find. And so to see them light up when they meet up here for play dates is just so fun, and to see those relationships bloom. Best thing from kids? There's just so many. I don't know. They love everything.
They do. They're all smiling. They're all happy. They're all playing independently and together. You have a nice little crowd here today. And so you're located just off of 25th Street in the same plaza as Bapa's Bagels, Family Fair. That's where it is. It's behind the Chipotle off of 25th Street. You have a website. What's the website?
It is WeRockTheSpectrumNorthDakota, all spelled out, .com.
So Lori Anderson is co-owner of We Rock the Spectrum Kids Gym here in Fargo, along with her husband. Lori, thanks for hanging out with me on Main Street. Thanks for allowing me to talk to you, and thanks for all you do for kids like ours.
Yeah, thank you. It takes every kind of people to make what life's about, yeah. It takes every kind of people
to make the world go around. You are listening to Member Supported Prairie Public on this Monday. I'm Eric Detheridge. Of course, yesterday was Father's Day, and maybe someday if I get the courage, I'll get on stage at the Tell in downtown Fargo and tell the live audience there about how my dad taught me a lesson in tolerance and acceptance from 1983 San Francisco, the epicenter at the time of the AIDS pandemic. It's a lifelong lesson that I carry with me today, but I haven't got the guts like our former director of radio, Bill Thomas, does at the Tell season finale, The Tell-Off, at the 4 and 4 in downtown Fargo back in May. He shared this tale of his understandable aversion, at least for a while, to sushi. But he starts it off with recounting how his dad was just being a great dad.
So in World War II, my father was in Europe with the U.S. Army, and he ended up having a lot to do with displaced persons, refugees, helped run a camp and helped a lot of different people. When he came back home from the war, that cause still had a place in his heart, and he continued to try to help out people who were in that, somehow in that kind of difficulty. So when I was 5 years old, Maria, the anti-communist Hungarian college student, ended up coming and living with us after the failed uprising against the communist government in Hungary. And I would go with him to buy shoes at this little shoe shop for this guy who had a really thick foreign accent. And innocently, I asked him one time why he had a number tattooed on his arm. And he just brushed it off. But my father later explained to me why that was and why he had helped him set up the shoe shop. So these kind of things went on in our lives. And as a little kid, that was just what life was. And as part of that, Arthur Tawada came into our life. Arthur Tawada was not a refugee in the sense that maybe these others were, but sort of. He was a Japanese American. He was born in like 1935 or 36, before World War II. And then, you know, one day the War Relocation Authority came to him and his father and mother and his little brother, they were all U.S. citizens, by the way, and said, you have 6 days to dispose of your landscaping business, your car, your house, most of your possessions. You can each take a suitcase. You're going to an internment camp. Not a prison camp. No, not a concentration camp. An internment camp. So he went off there with his family. His father was sent to a different camp and died there, probably of encephalitis, though there was a story that he'd been shot by a guard. And at the end of the war, there they were, and the U.S. said, well, if you want, we can put you on a boat with a bunch of other people, and you can go back to Japan. Well, for them, it wasn't really going back to Japan because they hadn't been there. But that's where his father's family was, and that was their refuge, was to go back to the father's family. You may have heard that the Japanese Americans who came back to Japan after World War II were not well received. And that was certainly his experience. And as soon as he turned 18, his mother had had them retain their U.S. citizenship. Several people renounced the citizenship, but they didn't. As soon as he turned 18, he enlisted in the United States Air Force and got out of Japan and ended up being demobilized in southern Illinois, near my hometown of Alton, Illinois, where he wanted to go to college and was looking for a place to live. And my father's helper people network put him in touch with us, and he ended up moving into our house, where he stayed through college, through graduate school, and eventually through the whole life of my parents. Well, he was quite a different feel in our house than my parents. He was more brash. He teased us a lot. He was a practical joker. He pulled pranks on us all the time. It was really different, and it was not bad, but just different. He had grown up mostly in Japan, and he cooked a lot of his own meals, so he brought Japanese cooking into the house. He would make these runs over to St. Louis and come back with a big bag of Japanese rice and shoyu sauce, very strong soy sauce, dried fish flakes, seaweed that was made like sheets of paper, dried seaweed, soybean curd, my least favorite of all the things that he brought back. I like it now, but... And now I know sophisticatedly to call it tofu, and it was just soybean curd. And he would sometimes do tempura dinners for all of us, which we all really loved. My dad liked to go fishing, and so sometimes we would take off on the weekend to go to a lake or a pond somewhere at a state park or county park. And Arthur liked to fish too, so he would come along. So one time when I was in third grade, we were at Beaver Dam State Park in southern Illinois, little lake, and somehow I ended up with Arthur with my little kid fishing rod, and he had his fishing rod, and we were fishing, and he caught a bluegill, and he pulled the bluegill in, and he cleaned it right away, and he turned to me and he said, you know, in Japan, we eat fish raw. Me, third grader, goes, you do not. You're making that up. You're trying to trick me. You don't eat. Nobody, why would anybody eat raw fish? He said, no, we do. And he had a lunchbox with him. He opened it up. had a jar in there with some rice in it, which that was not unusual. I had a peanut butter sandwich. He had a jar of rice. And he pulled out some rice, made a little cake about the size of a thumb, put a big slice of bluegill on top of the rice. And I said, "You're not going to eat that." He said, "Yeah." And my mouth is open, my eyes are open. He ate it. He said, "Billy, do you want some?" Uh-oh. A challenge, a dare, a third grader, a bad combination. I'm like, "Yeah." So he makes up some for me, puts a big slice of bluegill on top, gives it to me, and I'm like, "How did I get into this?" Put it in my mouth and just swallowed it. You know, the rice I was used to, the fish felt a little slimy going down. But I managed not to throw it up and became like 50 points for me. I ate raw fish. But I was sure that he had tricked me, that this was just a joke that he was doing. And I ran back and told my parents, "Hey, Art and I ate raw fish." And I don't know, they had a talk with him. Raw fish never came up again. He continued to live with my family. Fresh caught fish was around at different times from the Ozarks, from the Mississippi River, from ponds, but no more raw fish. And so, 20 years in the future, I'm at an alternative radio conference with a bunch of people from the Midwest, a few people from California, and the guy from California says, "Hey, let's go out for dinner tonight. There's this new restaurant in town that has sushi." And we all go, "Sushi? What's sushi?" He goes, "Oh, well," says, "sushi, you take like some of this sticky rice, you kind of make a little cake out of it about the size of your thumb, you put the raw fish on it, you dabble it in some sauce, and you eat it." And everybody's going like, "What? Ooh, raw fish? What are you talking about?" I am, my head is whirling with intense recalibration. And so everybody's talking to each other, and one of them turns to me and said, "Bill, have you ever had sushi?" And I'm kind of dazed in a way, and I say, "Yeah, I have. But it's been a long time." Thank you.
Sweet wife, catch more fish than you. Many fish bites if you got good bait. Here's a little tip that I would like to relate. Many fish bites if you got good bait. I'm a going fishing, yes, I'm going fishing, and my baby going fishing too.
That's former Prairie Public Director of Radio Bill Thomas making his third consecutive Monday Main Street appearance. Might have to make that a habit. Telling the story of his first taste of sushi and some other lessons that shaped his global cultural worldview. That might explain why he has instruments from all over the world hanging at his house. He takes them off the wall and plays them from time to time, too. The Tell, Fargo's live monthly storytelling event, had their season finale back in May. That's where we got Bill's story. After taking this month off, The Tell will be back in July at the 4 and 4 above Side Street Grill and Pub with a quote-unquote invitational, a night of curated stories by invited tellers. It's on July the 9th at 7 p.m. You can find more info on The Tell's Facebook page and Instagram. Well, you heard Taj Mahal singing about fishing. Well, on the banks of the Cheyenne River near Kindred lives an acclaimed outdoor writer who is drawn from decades of hunting, fishing, trapping, farming, and exploring wild places all across North Dakota and North America. Jeffrey Miller's latest book is The Golden Hour, More Adventures from the Field, Forest, and Water. Craig Blumenschein will speak with him after this regional news break.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. North Dakota schools are changing how they collect data to a system that could make that collection easier. Many schools in North Dakota use what's called PowerSchool, but under what the State Department of Public Instruction has called Project Bridge, they're changing to a tool called Infinite Campus. Why the change? Tony Ambrose is a consultant working on the project. He says right now, local districts have spent a lot of time collecting data that is sent to DPI or the federal government.
Having them all be completely separate caused us a lot of challenges over the years. And it causes a lot of time, energy, and effort by our districts to aggregate data on their own, prepare that information, and then send that to DPI so that DPI can combine it and do what we need to do with it.
Ambrose says the goal is to minimize the time and effort for school districts to gather the data.
And we'd like to turn that time back to them to concentrate on the core mission, which has nothing to do with technology, has nothing to do with systems, has nothing to do with that data. It has everything to do with educating our kids.
Ambrose says more than two-thirds of the state's school districts have gone through this conversion process, and he says the process should be completed by mid-July. And nearly half of the U.S. winter wheat crop is in poor or very poor condition. Farmers across the Great Plains states are yielding around 30 bushels an acre, about half of what they got last year. Others have had to abandon their crop altogether. Drought conditions affected many places, and a warmer winter than usual made the crop susceptible to heat, late freezes, and disease. Raymond Paris is a wheat farmer in northern Oklahoma.
Some places the wheat's real bad. West of here, it's a little drier. Wheat is dry all winter and hot. Probably the warmest February and March I've seen.
On top of high fuel and fertilizer prices, many wheat farmers are bracing to lose money harvesting their crop. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by LiveWire, providing live event audio, video, lighting, staging, and scenery for in-person, hybrid, and virtual events, serving clients throughout the Upper Midwest and nationwide. More at livewirenow.com.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. For some people, the outdoors is a pastime. For others, it's a way of life. Jeffrey Miller has spent decades hunting, fishing, trapping, farming, and exploring wild places across North America. And along the way, he's built a successful career as an outdoor writer with more than 175 stories appearing in magazines and newspapers across the country. His latest book, The Golden Hour, More Adventures from the Field, Forest, and Water, gathers many of those stories into a collection that celebrates adventure, conservation, family traditions, and the enduring connection between people and the natural world. Jeffrey joins us today from his Cottonwood Bench farm along the Cheyenne River to talk about his book that's just been released, the experiences behind it, and why the greatest adventures may be closer to home than we think. Jeffrey, welcome back to Main Street.
Hi, Craig. I'm happy to be here.
We are happy that you are with us. What inspired you to put together a second collection of outdoor stories after Forever Towards the Sunrise, which we had talked about earlier on Main Street?
Yeah, so I kind of figured that one would be the only one for quite a while. And late winter, I was kind of looking through my published stories and realized I had enough for a second book. So I figured it was time to put it together.
In your introduction, you described growing up devouring outdoor magazines and dreaming of becoming an outdoor writer. At what point did you realize, Jeff, for you, that dream was becoming real?
So I had my first story published in 2016, and I kind of thought it was going to be a one-off. And then I tried a couple more, and fortunately I had editors that kept buying it. So, you know, since probably 2020, 2021, I kind of had enough relationships to make a go at it as kind of a second career. So that's kind of when it really kicked in the drive.
You have so many stories. How do you decide which stories belonged in your newest book, The Golden Hour, and which ones didn't?
Yeah, so I do a lot of writing of how-to and adventure-type stuff, and I kind of figured for this book I wanted to kind of focus more on the adventure stuff and not the nuts and bolts stuff necessarily. So I kind of went through and found things that were adventure, not necessarily adventures away from home, but adventures that happened anywhere from the road to across the country.
Why the title, The Golden Hour?
So the first book Forever Towards the Sunrise. I kind of thought that's always working towards the sunrise, you know, as a hunter or fisherman. But honestly, the best time to be in the fields, forest, or water is kind of that golden hour, that last half hour or so before dark, when the light kind of stretches across the horizon and everything kind of has that pretty goldenish hue. So I kind of figured that's, I want to celebrate that time.
Jeff, many of your stories appeared in magazines, and now you put them together, collected them in a book. Is it different for you to look at the stories collected that way?
It sure is. You know, when you're writing a magazine story, you're focused on that story. Once it's written, it's kind of over. But when you put it in a book, you can kind of see how things ebb and flow across the page. And, you know, some of the stories I didn't put in because they were somewhat redundant. I tried to kind of have a little bit of everything to kind of tie it together into more of a cohesive book rather than just a collection of random stories.
Joel Spring writes in the foreword that some of your stories combine practical knowledge with heart and soul. How do you balance the technical side of hunting and fishing with storytelling?
It's actually pretty easy because technically wise, I'm probably pretty average, middle of the road hunter. I never try to confess or profess to be a, you know, an expert in anything. And but I do enjoy kind of the romantic part of the outdoors. But for me, that's pretty easy. Sometimes I have to work a little bit on the technical aspect, but the romantic side is pretty easy.
So what comes first for you? Is it the hunt, fishing, and then the story, or the story in your mind, now I'm going to live it?
You know, it's kind of funny. It's kind of each way. You know, sometimes if I'm going on a trip, I've kind of got a little bit of a kernel of what happens if the story or if the trip goes the way I want it to. You know, other times you kind of write after it's over, and especially if it's been a unique experience. Because, you know, realistically, every time outdoors is unique. You know, every time you go deer hunting is different than the previous time, or fishing or whatever. So, you know, you kind of try to find a little bit of something different, you know, to tell kind of the story, and at the end, and then tie it back into the nuts and bolts.
Enjoying my conversation with Jeffrey Miller. He spent decades hunting, fishing, trapping, farming, and exploring wild places across North America, and especially here in North Dakota. And he has a successful career as an outdoor writer, and he's now published The Golden Hour, More Adventures from the Field, Forest, and Water. Jeff, some of the most touching moments in the introduction involve your parents encouraging your outdoor interests. How much of this book is about family?
Quite a bit of it. Not only my actual blood family, but, you know, my kind of family of friends that are as close as, you know, people can be that aren't your family. But, you know, it all kind of stemmed from my parents encouraging me to find what I liked and, you know, encouraging me and helping me hunt when they had to drive me to the woods or would have to come out and help me blood trail a deer, take photos, or, you know, we talk a lot about, you know, parents and their kids playing sports, and I played sports too, but, you know, my parents are really supportive of my love of the outdoors and kind of encouraged me to keep doing it. And, you know, my mom especially encouraged me to read and write, you know, even back when I wasn't doing it for anybody but myself.
You write about checking traps with your dad as a child. And looking back, what lessons from those early experiences still stay with you today? And I'm going to take a guess, and the answer is going to be a lot of them, because it's what you live for now, it seems to me.
Yeah. And, you know, I think the best part of it is that, especially with outdoor writing, it's easy to focus on the success. You know, when you go out there and the deer that you want to harvest comes by and you shoot it and everything's great. But a lot of life doesn't work that way. Things don't work out the way that they're supposed to. And I think that really, I learned that as a young kid, you know, going out with my dad, and we didn't always get stuff. And, you know, I talk about in the introduction, I fell into the cold water, you know, and it's kind of went into life where there's really good things that happen in life, and there's things that don't necessarily happen the way you want it to. And you have to learn how to deal with that, you know, both in the outdoors and in your home life.
You're a busy father. You have kids that are involved in athletics and activities and a lot of different things. But you also try to share this with your daughters. You and I have talked about that before. How's that working out?
Yeah, so, you know, my daughters are, two of them are teenagers and one's almost. They've got their own things that they enjoy. You know, my middle daughter has hunted deer before, but they're not necessarily into it as much as I am. But even if that's the case, we still will spend some time trapping or fishing, or they're exposed to, you know, we eat most of the meat we eat as wild. So I was told when I had kids that don't expect them to love everything that you do. And that was good advice. And that's true. And I didn't want to force it onto them, but I want them to know about it and, you know, at least have those memories when they do grow up and go off and have their own family.
Your book covers everything from black bear hunting in Manitoba to trout fishing in my native land of Wyoming and deer hunting close to home. There's a certain story that was kind of the most fun to relive while you were putting the book together.
It's funny you mentioned the Wyoming story. That was probably, you know, we just talked a little bit about things not going right. That trip was perfect from start to end. The weather was beautiful. The animals were abundant. The people were friendly. It was one of the best trips I've ever been on. And that one was kind of fun to relive and remember, you know, central Wyoming and the fall and how absolutely breathtaking it was.
The Manitoba bear story, the hunt story, is filled with suspense and mosquitoes and a tough tracking job for you. What made that experience unforgettable?
It was the tough tracking job. It was very difficult for me to kind of stay on the trail. The guide did a great job, but the big thing that I remember was the mosquitoes. It was, we always talk about North Dakota here and Minnesota, how bad the mosquitoes are. And, you know, we're in the minor leagues when it comes to Canada and mosquitoes. They were absolutely dreadful. So it's kind of that type two fun where when it's happening at the time, it's not necessarily great, but when you can look back on it, you can kind of forget the tough parts.
Do you have an adventure that didn't make it into the book that you're looking back now and thinking, geez, that probably deserves a chapter maybe in my next book?
Yeah, you know, so I've got a couple that are coming out very soon. And generally magazines, when you sell them the story, they get the first rate to publish it. So I had a couple that I would have loved to include, but they hadn't been published yet. And one of them was called Getting Back on the Horse. And it's kind of about when I missed the deer I was after, or some of the stuff when things went really wrong and kind of how to mentally move past that and get back on the horse and go enjoy it again. So I would have loved to include that one, but it just hadn't been published yet.
Jeff, throughout the book, there's a strong conservation ethic. How have hunting and fishing shaped your understanding of stewardship?
So it's been really important. You know, during my day job at the Cass County Soil Conservation, we do a lot of conservation work. And you know, it's easy to look at hunters and fishermen and trappers as enjoying the outdoors to kind of be a consumptive nature, right? You go out and shoot a deer, I take that deer off the landscape. And it's kind of got me more into realizing the ecology of the outdoors. You know, it's not necessarily just killing the deer, but having good habitat for, you know, a wood frog. Or, you know, on the prairie, having bobolinks and, you know, kind of the non-game species and plants and trees. And I was actually just up in Manitoba earlier this week. And when we were going through the woods, I was kind of pointing out different plants. And the guide was kind of like, well, I didn't know what that was called. And so it's kind of neat. It expands the outdoor experience to kind of understand everything rather than just the act of trying to shoot something.
The book is called The Golden Hour, More Adventures from the Field, Forest, and Water. And I'm visiting with its author, Jeffrey Miller. What is it that you hope non-hunters, non-fishermen understand better about modern hunting and wildlife management after they maybe have read your book?
So I always hope that people that aren't hunters or fishermen or outdoors people at all kind of understand both the love that outdoors people have for it, but also understand that that they can love the outdoors without being consumptive users, right? You can photograph outside, you can hike, birdwatch. You know, I've started really birdwatching a lot the last year or two. And, you know, the hunting season is not super long. So there's more to enjoy than just hunting or fur trapping. And, you know, fur trapping is a real delicate topic because, you know, during the 90s, fur trapping really came under fire and there was a lot of misunderstanding about the practice and the art. And I hope that people read about it. I mean, if they're not interested in trapping, realize that trappers love the animals they pursue. It's a necessary practice on the landscape, especially in today's human manipulated landscape. And that there's room for all of us in the outdoors, no matter what our passions are.
Speaking of human manipulation, you write a lot about significant changes in habitat in wildlife populations and outdoor recreation over the years. What concerns you the most today?
It is habitat loss, especially in the Midwest. You know, we're fortunate that we just in North Dakota here had the governor's habitat and soil health program come out. You know, this year there's less deer gun license than there have been for 40 years in the state. And that's not really because of winters or over harvest, it's because of lack of habitat. And, you know, habitat is the zone. If we don't have habitat, we don't have wildlife. And that may be deer, salamanders, bobolinks, anything that we're interested in the outdoors. So, the important thing is people realizing how important habitat is. And habitat, farming, or industry are not divergent. They both happen at the same time. And it just takes the desire for everybody on the landscape to really care about it, figure out ways to make it all work together.
One of the themes that stand out to me about your writing is your belief that adventure doesn't require traveling halfway around the world. And you write that the wild is wherever we can find it. What does that mean to you living here in North Dakota?
Yeah, so, you know, especially Eastern North Dakota is not necessarily wilderness, right? It's heavily farmed. There's people around. But, you know, whether it's bow hunting along the river, but I always seem to find the wild when I'm checking traps in the dark before work in the morning. And there isn't much going on. Owls are hooting. You know, the night creatures are kind of getting ready to go to bed. And it really does feel like you're kind of in the wilderness. And, you know, I go home and drop my catch off and then head home or back to work. And in that, as the sun comes up, people start going to work and it's modern world again. For that little bit of time, maybe a half hour, an hour, I kind of get to live that wilderness life every day.
Do you have a favorite place to be outside in North Dakota when you're not working?
Yeah, I would have to say the Cheyenne National Grassland area. It's absolutely beautiful. There's a lot of places there that you can look at and realize that it hasn't changed since pre-settlement. It's a really unique place and it really feels like home.
Is there an outdoor skill that you're still trying to master, Jeff? And I'll tell you, I can't imagine what it would be.
You know, it's funny. I've been very successful bow hunting, but there's certain times you're sitting in a tree stand thinking to yourself, how am I ever going to get a deer with my bow? You know, even though it's modern, with like compound bows and stuff, it's a skill that I don't think I'll ever say that I've mastered. You know, I've enjoyed practicing it for probably over 30 years now, but it's something that's still, you've got to be on your game. It's kind of like golf, right? You never feel like you've mastered golf. It's a lifelong sport. And that's kind of the way I feel with bow hunting and archery.
Kind of wrap it up, Jeff, when readers turn that final page of The Golden Hour, what do you hope they're feeling?
I hope they're feeling that no matter where they are, and that the adventure's right there. And, you know, don't overlook going to your lake cabin and going and catching some bass. Like, really, really treasure that. And, you know, and also kind of enjoy that time with friends and family, and kind of start thinking ahead of you know, for new adventures. And I think that's the key, is that it's fun what's happened, but there's always more things to experience.
Where can we find the book, Jeff?
So you can find it on Amazon. Both the ebook and the paperback are available. My Facebook page on Cottonwood Bend Farm is, you can purchase autographed copies. And there'll probably be some other websites down the road where it's available, but Amazon is probably the easiest.
Jeffrey Miller is the author of The Golden Hour, More Adventures from the Field, Forest, and Water, just released. It's a collection of stories celebrating hunting, fishing, trapping, conservation, family traditions, and the enduring rewards of time spent outdoors. And the book follows his earlier works, Forever Towards the Sunrise, Our Bend in the River, and Clausburg, North Dakota. Jeff, it's always a pleasure. Congratulations, and thanks for sharing time with us on Main Street.
Craig, I'm very happy to have spent this time with you.
Craig Blumenschein in conversation with author Jeffrey Miller. Hope you enjoyed that conversation. I'm Eric Dethridge. Craig, by the way, will be back in the hosting chair for Main Street tomorrow. Well, there's a wren that sings pretty complex melodies. You'll be impressed when you hear some delightful singing on Bird Note coming up in just a minute. Hey, if you're listening during the 3 p.m. Central broadcast, All Things Considered is coming your way at the top of the hour, and you'll hear more about the legacy of longtime Federal Reserve Chair Alan Greenspan, who died today at the age of 100. He's being remembered as a master of monetary policy who oversaw long periods of economic growth. If you are hearing us during the evening version of Main Street, stay tuned for Hidden Brain with Shankar Vedantam, who asks, why are acts of kindness so powerful? The hidden perks of doing things for others is coming up next on Hidden Brain.
Hi, I'm Danielle Webster. Now listen, I know you're busy. I mean, of course you are. Life is fast. Kids don't move themselves. You've got to jostle them out of bed, get them ready for school, get on with your day. And don't even get me started on that evening bedtime routine. And our day-to-day lives may not leave a lot of time to catch up on news for a civically-minded person like you, but that's where Prairie Beat comes in. If you've got 10 minutes, we'll catch you up on some of the big regional stories impacting, well, just about everybody around here. Subscribe to Prairie Beat wherever you get your podcasts. New episodes drop every Wednesday.
This is Bird Note. Tropical rainforests are stunning places. They support half of the world's biodiversity. They're found in just a few regions, such as the Amazon, the Congo River Basin in Africa, and Indonesia. The variety of life forms stands out visually, from the rainbow feathers of the scarlet macaw to the fantastic iridescence of the birds of paradise. And there's diversity in sound, too, from the wide-ranging whistles of the screaming piha to the otherworldly melodies of the musician wren. The relationship between people and rainforests runs deep. Indigenous communities continue to steward large areas of rainforests. And these ecosystems store roughly 40% of the world's carbon, keeping it out of the atmosphere where it would contribute to climate change. So keeping rainforests healthy means keeping people safe too. Today is World Rainforest Day, which recognizes the importance of safeguarding rainforests for future generations. Many of our actions can affect rainforests around the globe. Learn more about your connections with rainforests on our website, birdnote.org. I'm Ariana Remmel.
This is Dakota Datebook for June 22nd. During World War I, despite American neutrality, military mobilization was already underway. North Dakotans answered the call when President Wilson mobilized the National Guard for duty along the Mexican border in response to turmoil from the Mexican Revolution and Pancho Villa's raid on Columbus, New Mexico, in March of 1916. The guardsmen garrisoned the border, freeing regular army troops to pursue Villa and his allies. On this date in 1916, Judson resident Joe Harris was hailed as the Paul Revere of 1916 by the Bismarck Daily Tribune for riding out to alert fellow guardsmen of their mobilization orders. Born in England in 1885, Harris immigrated to America in 1901, first settling in Kansas before homesteading near Judson in 1912. With one squad member living 7 miles from town and others 4 miles away in the opposite direction, Harris rode into the countryside to deliver the news. By the time the train pulled into Mandan, the squad was on board. The Judson squad included Corporal Joe Harris, Walter Tepke, William Tepke, Paul Just, Nathaniel Stark, Hugo Detman, and Henry Keller. The New Salem Journal reported that Captain G.I. Solem of Company F wired Harris to assemble the men. The squad members were farmers, and at Harris's call, they dropped the handles and left the plows in the field, drove cedar teams to barns, and hurried to the railroad. Even though 5 of the men had completed their enlistments, that made no difference to them. They came anyway. Several members of the Judson squad later served in World War I. Detman served overseas with the 357th Infantry Regiment and was severely wounded in battle. Stark served in the machine gun company of the 362nd Infantry Regiment, while Walter Tepke joined the Students' Army Training Corps at the University of Minnesota. Though Harris never served overseas in the Great War, he instead led a quiet farming life before retiring to New Salem with his wife, Martha, in October of 1959. While the war in Europe overshadowed the situation with Mexico, it served as a first test for several North Dakotans who later served over there and joined the ranks of the millions called to serve our nation over the last 250 years. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Daniel Sauerwein. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding by the Study ND, North Dakota's largest lifelong learning community.
All right, that's it for this Monday edition of Main Street. I'm Eric Dethridge, and hey, that's it for me as far as guest hosting Main Street while Craig Blumenschein was away. Good news, Craig will be back with you tomorrow, but it has been my pleasure sitting in for him and having the chance to spend some time with you. Thank you so much for listening to Prairie Public. We really do appreciate it.